show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 1872, the American merchant vessel Mary Celeste was discovered adrift off the coast of the Azores. Her cargo was intact, and there was no sign of a struggle. But the crew was gone, and they were never found. In her new novel, The Ghost of Mary Celeste, Valerie Martin imagines the human dimensions of this unsolved maritime mystery with a character list that includes Arthur Conan Doyle. It is a great pleasure to welcome Valerie Martin to this week's book show. Thank you very much for spending time with us. A delight to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
What brought you to the sea?
Well, my father was a sea captain. I'm from New Orleans. And so the notion of men who go away for long periods of time and then come back from this place was very much part of my growing up. And I think I read about this ship, the Mary Celeste, when I was in fifth grade in New Orleans. I read it in a weekly reader. I can still remember the name of the magazine. And I was intrigued by the story. And I was just a kid, and I told my father about it on one of his periods when he was actually at home with us, which wasn't really that often. And he knew about it and was interested in it. I think it probably stuck in my memory because most of the things I told him about didn't interest him. But the fact that he knew about this story and said a little bit about, you know, what he knew about it just kept it in my memory for many years. So some years ago, and I'm not sure where or when, it wasn't a weekly reader, I learned that there was a woman and child aboard on that ship, and that was something I had not known until that time. And that's when I began to be interested in this particular story and this particular voyage.
Because that was considered bad luck.
Well, that's what brought me to it was I thought women on ship, that was bad luck. But when I began to look into it, I found that that was not the case at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of women went to sea, especially on whalers, because they'd be gone for years at a time. And sometimes captains were so poor, they didn't even have a home on land. And so babies were born at sea and learned to walk before they ever got to shore, which is a wonderful thing to think about. The more research I did about that, the more I thought, well, this is a world I've really never imagined. It was not uncommon at all for a captain to take his wife and child aboard with him for fairly long voyages. In the case of the Briggses, who were on the Mary Celeste, they on their honeymoon they went to Genoa and they went to Sicily, and also during the Civil War they went down to New Orleans and got shot at by the rebels.
The novel begins with this incredible loss at sea, and I'm curious as to how you decided to start at that place, because it is such a it's a beautiful piece of writing, but it's really turbulent.
It's a dark place.
It is.
Yeah, it was not the original opening. The original opening was a diary that starts shortly after that. This book came together for me over a period of 5 years in various pieces. There were points where I wasn't sure what the first page would be. But at some point, I realized that chronologically, the death of Benjamin's sister, Maria, and her young husband, Captain, aboard a ship off the coast of Cape Fear that was hit by a steamer, it was 1859, was really the chronological beginning of my story. It was the first loss. It wasn't the first loss in that family. Actually, his older brother died at sea. But it was the first woman in the family who just simply disappeared from a ship.
When you thought about how to tell the story, you did not want to go in a linear fashion. There are many voices, there are many places, there are fragments that come together to tell this tale.
Yeah, I think I knew from the start that I wanted it to be a very impressionistic feeling for the reader. This notion of a ship drifting out into and out of the mist, and the disappearance of real people. I think my feeling was I wanted to get the reader invested in the lives of the real people and then take them away and then bring them back and then take them away. I wanted this sense of things being very much adrift in time and space and this impression of love and of loss. Now, one thing that affected me in my reading was the marriage between Benjamin and Sarah. They were first cousins. They grew up in the same house together. And they were extraordinarily close. and you know that they disappeared from this ship together struck me as one of those love stories that I don't usually want to fool with stories like that. But I was very attracted to their. I read some of their letters, and their letters suggested that they were both. They were very witty and ironic, very religious. Of course, she was the son of a preacher, but they were a lively pair. She did love music and was known for her beautiful voice. And he read a chapter of the Bible every day and was teetotal. But he was a great joker. And he and his brother were, they liked to, you know, play pranks on their father, who was also a captain. So they were very alive to me after I read those letters.
In the writing of the story, there are times where you'll read about Sarah and Benjamin, and their fate will be somewhat suspended, and then we'll come back to that. Was that the way you wrote it as well?
To some extent, it was. What happened was when I started to do research about the ship and the theories about what might have happened, I ran into this Arthur Conan Doyle connection very early. Everyone who's written about the ship writes about Arthur Conan Doyle's short story, which he wrote 12 years after the events, which is the ship was found empty and there was a long trial. Everyone in Britain knows about the Mary Celeste because it was an Admiralty trial in Gibraltar. So he wrote a story purporting to solve the mystery, which was his way. It was always to solve a mystery. It was one of his most successful early stories, and it really gave him the hope that he might have a writing career, the reception to it. But it wasn't published under his name because it was published in a magazine that always published anonymous stories. People, it was sort of a fun thing to try to figure out who wrote the story. And in fact, the story that Conan Doyle wrote about the Mary Celeste was reviewed by someone, and this pleased him immensely, saying that it might have been written by Robert Louis Stevenson. Mm. And he wrote to his mother saying, well, you know, it's too bad they don't know it's me, but this is a great comparison.
Felt like he had arrived.
Yeah, he really did feel like he'd arrived with his story. But what he did in solving the mystery was throw a whole lot of material in it, because he was writing fiction, as I am. That wasn't, shall we say, exactly verifiable, and some of it was really outrageously imaginative. And some of the things that he says about the ship and the people on it stuck to the story, so much so that even the family was eventually confused by certain details, such as was there a cat on the ship or not, because they appeared in his story. They immediately just stuck to the factual accounts of the story. Well, that was very appealing to me as a writer. Because when I write historical fiction, you know, I have some understanding of what the facts are, what really happened. But I'm constantly embroidering or trying to figure out what might have happened. Mm. And I really do make an effort to not write anything that couldn't have happened. But at the same time, I don't want to be held to any, you know, requirement that everything be factual. And that's pretty much what Conan Doyle did with this story.
So do you almost sympathize and understand what he was going through in writing this story?
Oh, yes, I'm totally with him. The story is kind of an outrageous fantasy of empire. He solved the mystery by imagining that there was a black man on the ship who killed everyone one by one because he had been a slave and hated white people. And then he takes the ship to Africa. It's just a wild and crazy solution. And, of course, we know there were no passengers on the ship. But still in all, it was Conan Doyle's kind of wonderful fantasy and his ability to make you believe that that might have been the case that made the story successful. So I'm all for him.
Valerie Martin is our guest on the book show this week. The name of the new novel is The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. It's fascinating to me because you mentioned that the novel is very much about loss, but also so much about absence, the sense of absence on that ship, and it's where the ghosts come, of where, I mean, right down to the cover, where there's this very much an in and out, nothing concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more I read about the 19th century, and especially when you think about what the world is like today, the possibility of disappearing was so much greater. You know, as a writing teacher, I've discussed with other writing teachers how these days when our students want to write a story about someone who goes away, the first thing they have to do is get rid of their cell phone. it runs out or something. But this was not a problem, the ability of people to simply disappear for years on end and then return, or to, as happened with the Mary Celeste, to disappear from a ship and have it be found 2 weeks later, and there's never any clue as to what really happened. No one knows. And the other sort of absence, I guess, is the large section of the book is about spiritualism, the movement of that was very popular all throughout the mid-19th and well into the 20th century. And this was the dawn of seances and table turning and talking to the dead, people taking dictation. And it was often young women who made their livings as clairvoyants and brought people to believe that they could speak to their dead relatives. And Conan Doyle was one of those. He was almost addicted to spiritualism and spent the last years of his life traveling the world trying to persuade people of the truth of this, what he thought was going to be the new great world religion.
This comes in the character of Violet Petra. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to what you wanted to explore with that character and how this character comes in and out of the story and also in and out of really the lives of these characters.
Yeah, she touches almost every life in the story. Part of it is, I really like conversation in novels about ideas. And my whole feeling about these young women who became clairvoyants is in many ways they were just frauds, but they were encouraged to be frauds, often by wealthy men or wealthy women who had lost children and wanted to be in touch with them. So there's an argument to be made that what she does is evil, and there's an argument to be made that what she does is innocent. She's a complex character. I think she's one of my favorite characters that I've ever invented, because you never can really nail her down. She's trying to make her way in the world, and she's a woman without money or family. We figure out why she is without money or family. But when she first appears, she simply appears with this ability to talk to the dead. And her story is narrated by a woman who, like me, is very doubtful that this could possibly be. So having those two characters at the center of the novel, basically discussing the possibility of ghosts and the notion that there might be some way of going beyond death, of reaching beyond death, not on a regular basis, but even for a minute. That was an idea that I wanted to entertain, and so those two characters, they come to like each other in spite of the fact that one has set out to discredit the other.
It is a novel that is filled with questions, of course, the obvious being what happened on the Mary Celeste, but also that question of Violet Petra, and is she a genuine psychic or is she a fraud? And are these losses will or are they chance? And it seems, and this has been said, I've read this about your writing, that you're comfortable with ambiguity.
Oh yes, very much so.
that idea of I'll lay the questions out there, but I don't have to answer them.
Yeah, it's reached the point where I think I should have put a disclaimer on the front of this book that says the mystery of the Mary Celeste is not solved in this novel. And I was thrilled that somebody responding to this complaint on Amazon said, it's a mystery. Why would it be solved, right?
Right.
It hasn't been solved. It's not going to be solved. That's one of the reasons I'm writing about it. I'm attracted to that whole notion that mysteries, they don't have to be solved to make us think of stories. In fact, if they're not solved, it generates stories. And that's what happens with this, in this book. Whatever happened on that ship, we'll never know. But it generated a lot of imagination on the part of people who heard about it or knew about it. It made people tell stories. It makes people tell stories. I'm interested in making people think up their own stories. So I don't solve that one. I do solve, however, the giant rat of Sumatra case. And so I think I should have credit for that. I've closed it.
Close
it's
that down.
Solved. It's done.
So what do you feel then that your role is in as a writer and as a writer of historical fiction then of filling in those blanks, filling in those gaps, and yet creating new ones for us to allow us to
walk in.
To walk in and to fill in our own
walk
gaps.
In freely. I do have a feeling about the past that you know, we can't really go there. You can't get a ticket, especially if you go before technology. We don't have photographs, we don't have recorded voices. We have paintings. We can have some visual notions of what the world was like, but it's really very much up for grabs. It's very hard to hear the voices that people spoke in, even if you read their letters, because if we write letters, we don't usually speak the way we write letters. It's often a very different sort of voice. So it's in a way, it's open territory. It's like the West, you know. I feel like the past, you should be able to go there. And I like to write historical fiction because I like to read about the past and then I'm trying to give a real visceral sense of what it might have been like, what the, you know, temperature in the air was like, what the feeling of conversation was like, what things looked like and felt like. But I'm really trying to give a sense of what the psychology of the people who accepted the systems that were in place might have been like. And that's why I'm so interested in conversation.
You wrote an essay that got a lot of attention about the notion of using fiction to de-romanticize the world. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think in this book it's rather a romanticization of the world, although I do try to kind of pin spiritualism down on the table and clip its wings with a couple of pins. I'm trying to do a little dissecting there. Yeah, I used to think, well, I'm a realist and everybody else is a romantic, but I'm doing both, and I actually love both. I love Stevenson and, you know, Conan Doyle's wonderful stories. They're just delightful. At the same time, I really enjoy the writers that they didn't like. As we spoke of Henry James earlier, and not liking being horrified by Zola, so was Robert Louis Stevenson. So I guess as a writer, I'm kind of torn between those two. Some days I feel I want to just tell a romantic tale. I've been writing some stories about the old South, about the bayous in Louisiana, and they're very romantic, kind of mythic tales. But at the same time, I'm attracted to not making people feel all comfortable about the past, because I think the past is responsible. Or there, you know, what we believe today is the result of what we believe about the past. And if we want to believe, say, that the South had a righteous cause, we'll act one way in, say, in the Civil War. If we don't want to believe then, we'll act another way. And so it's important what we believe. It's not so important what really happened. It's important what we believe about why it happened.
And also this idea of extinction, and is there really such a thing? Meaning that we think that things are done.
Oh, yeah. Things are never done.
They're not.
They're not done. Now, I'm going to be on a panel next week in New Orleans, and I think the title is Not Even Over, which is a quote from Faulkner about the old South. It's the past is not past. It's not even past. That's right. It's not over. It's not even past, is what he said. Yeah, the past doesn't just go away. It's constantly reverberating and being reinterpreted by historians who tell us that they're, you know, only interested in the facts. But sometimes the facts are contradictory.
When you look at the novel, there are times where, certainly in subject matter, where it can be very grim.
Mm.
And yet that is, you almost revel in that, because it is where we so often are.
I think about sadness a lot, and this book caused me to read some 19th century poets who were really willing to be sad. And it's one of the things I think, you know, especially in my teaching, watching young people who have sometimes it seems to me a terror of being sad. They think it means something's wrong. Now, I'm not talking about depression.
Right.
That can be a clinical thing, and that's a very terrible thing. But just a sense, and I think it happens to us as we get older, that innocence is lost, that we are different. When I watch the great joy that my little granddaughters take just in, you know, eating or I'm standing up, look at that. I feel that joy is something I can never feel again. And so I'm sad. But at the same time, I recognize it. It's not alien to me, and it's a wonderful sadness. So in some ways, this book has that, I hope, has that quality of a real, the sadness of loss, but it's not hopelessness. Mm-hmm. It's just that, I think it's a sadness that provokes poetry, and it also provokes people who, you know, want to make beautiful art.
And you writing about it, I mean, that's, that in and of itself is beautiful art. It is...
Thank you for saying that.
Well, thank you. It seems as though when you... Because I would much rather be embraced in this thoughtfulness and, yes, a sadness than more so than I would want to just be bathed in happiness and joy.
It's gooiness.
Right.
Yes.
We enjoy that. We like to, I think most of us as readers, like to have that sense of not only, which is why I love mysteries, but that of the unknown, but also of, again, back to ambiguity.
Yeah, it's as you say about mysteries, I mean, when you're reading a mystery, you're hoping for a solution, but the pleasure of it comes when you're in the middle.
Right.
And you're thinking, what in the world happened? What really happened? When people write standard mysteries, they give you the answer at the end, and that's all fine. But you went through that period of confusion, and I think that's what draws you to the mystery, not the solution. So the fact that I don't provide a solution to this particular mystery, I can't. I actually have speculated in a way that I don't believe some things that I don't want to give away my ending, but I have some notion of one thing that might have happened, but I don't know what the solution to the mystery is. But I do want the reader to enter that place where you think, what's up with this world? And it's both sadness and ability to speculate. It's both a fear of loss, especially of, you know, if you're caught up in a story and you're trying to figure out what really happened. There's that sense of being at sea, which is why my book is maybe in many ways why I was drawn to write about the sea, because we say I'm at sea when we mean I have no idea what comes next.
Adrift.
Yeah.
And yet we tend to, again, we enjoy that often, that feeling, because it is, there's a romantic notion as well to the sea.
Oh yeah. Yes. Many people, I'm terrified of water and never go in boats, but I do like to walk on the sea. You know, when you stand on the shore and look at it, I mean, since I'm from New Orleans, I look at it now with a different, slightly different sensation. I certainly never want to live near water again. And as we know, the waters are rising. In fact, I think in some ways people are beginning to feel a little differently about the sea, and maybe it's a little less romantically, which might be good.
Because we understand its power.
I think you're right.
The name of the new novel is The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. The novel is published by Doubleday. Valerie Martin, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for
spending time. Oh, it's a pleasure to be
time.
Here.
A delight. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the program. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. This show was recorded at Argo Studios in New York City. Our thanks to their crew. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.